Welcome back. It's the Politics Show here on Bristol Community 93.2 FM. I'm still Billy Quain, sitting in for Tony Gosling with Martin Summers. And I'm delighted to say, any moment we should be able to cross over live to Tony Gosling in Germany, who's attending, he's monitoring the Bilderberg Group meeting of 2016. Tony Gosling, can you hear me loud and clear?
I certainly can, Billy. Yeah, it's a beautiful evening here, actually, in Dresden. Most famous, really, for the bombing from the Second World War. The Red Army, I've been told by the people who live in Dresden here, was only 60 miles away, and it was heading for Dresden. And so a lot of people asked questions on all sides after the Second World War, why from the 13th to the 15th of February 1945, the Allies sought fit to send 1,250 bombers over, heavy bombers with 4,000 tons of bombs to drop and destroy Dresden, since it was going to be liberated anyway by the Russians very soon afterwards, and 25,000 people died there. So that's one of the things many people may know Dresden for. It was part of the former East Germany.
And also, I guess, for the reconstruction, because the post-war planners decided to rebuild the historic city centre much in the style that it was before the bombs dropped.
Well, they've certainly made a good start at it since the reunification of Germany, and I can say I'm extremely impressed by the kind of civic pride there is here. I think, you know, the Bristol's leaders have got a lot to learn from the Germans. I mean, just literally coming over the bridge when I first arrived in the city from, I think it was the Academy, a gigantic, great, kind of Gothic-like building, the windows were open and you could hear a symphony orchestra playing as you come across the bridge, as a way to welcome you into the old city.
Well, fancy that. German investment in the arts, imagine. Now, it's Bilderberg time of year. Tell me a little bit about the group.
The Bilderberg Group is really a power networking group, but I nicknamed them, and it's sort of something that came into my head on the plane on the way over here. This is the gang that killed Kennedy. There are a lot of connections between the people that set up the Bilderberg conferences back in the 1950s and the Kennedy assassins. I mean, we're talking about the military-industrial complex faction, if you want, within the CIA, the FBI, and in the US government. And they were also looking across to Europe very, very closely to hope and make sure that European countries didn't start voting communist governments in. They were very worried that that might happen, particularly in Italy. The CIA spent more than on any other operation on fixing elections in Italy. So the Bilderberg Group was part of that, and it was chaired for its first 20 years from 1954 to 1974 by this former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. And it's really the SS connection that most worried me when I first came across this group in the mid-1990s, and I've been following it ever since, really. And it's been great to see the amount of attention and interest in the group grow over the decades to now. There has been a lot of interest in the German press, some very good coverage in the local newspapers over here too. So things have been changing over the 20 years it is now that I've been covering these conferences, Billy.
They're an interesting outfit, not least because they're not terribly press friendly, are they?
Well, up until 1975, they had a press conference every year because I think when they first started, they realised that this was going to be a necessity. And then in 1975, there was the Lockheed scandal. You might remember a chambermaid in Prince Bernhard's hotel found a whole load of notes which showed that he had been taking bribes from Lockheed to get the Dutch government to buy Lockheed Starfighter jets, and that these were actual evidence of that. And there was a big scandal with Bernhard being totally discredited. And so from that time onwards, there's never been a press conference at the Bilderberg, even though the press interest has grown almost exponentially over the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, we had 5,000 people come to protest and really to witness, including lots of people to report on it in Watford when the Bilderbergs were last in Britain, Billy.
Well, a fascinating group of people, not least because, frankly, nobody knows what's going on behind the closed doors. Now, I know that you're desperately keen to get the interrogation underway with Glenn Bolton and Daniel Kirby, two British journalist activists who are sharing some Dresden airspace with you as we speak. So, Tony Gosling, over to you, live in Dresden.
Okay. Thanks, Billy. First, just like to say hello to Daniel Kirby. Daniel, tell us, what's your motive to be here? I first found about Bilderberg in about 2005 when I was researching sort of corporate power and transnational elite networking and transparency and stuff like that. They're the main issues that got me into Bilderberg in the first place, I'd say, about 10 years ago.
What's your role, do you think, when you come along to one of these meetings? I mean, I see it just for me. It's just something I want to see, I want to witness. What about yourself?
Yeah, a bit of that as well, but I also like taking pictures, so you know, I can see, helping Charlie out and Hannah out with some photography and meeting people here and meeting all kinds of people of more sort of shapes and sizes from sort of different sort of political spectrums and beliefs and views.
Well, look, tell us whereabouts in the country you're from, whereabouts in Britain you're from, and what's your background? I mean, what skills do you think you bring to this?
I currently live in Chester in England. I'm originally from the Isle of Man. I study history and international journalism at John Moores University and Chester University. So I quite like the historical side of Bilderberg as well, being a sort of into history myself. So yeah, I spend a lot of time sort of looking at the older connections of Bilderberg, the Agnellis and the Prince Bernhard.
All right, now he's the guy that used to run Fiat, isn't he, Agnelli? Okay, what about this particular conference? I mean, because you've been to a few now, have you?
Yeah, I've been. This is my fifth, I think, so far.
Anything you've noticed about this one?
It's in a beautiful city. I like it when they have it in a beautiful city rather than in the middle of nowhere. You get to see some of the sights while you're here as well. But there's quite a good view here of the delegates going in and out. They don't like transparency, but then they don't seem too bothered about hiding themselves away, too far away in the country. So, yeah, it's always good to see them going in and out.
I mean, is there really any point to you taking the photos? Are you able to actually get them out to the in the press and that sort of thing?
Not so much, no, but there's Twitter, there's other means of getting photographs out there, and it's good to have an archive online of photographs. They put out a list of attendees now, but it's also good to have faces to put to the names.
Yeah, the other thing is, of course, it really helps to have more eyes and ears around the conference, because sometimes people wander out, maybe with one of the security guards, and no one notices, or, you know, there are kind of almost informal shifts of journalists around these conferences. Would you just like to draw our attention to any of the particular attendees you've seen this year?
Peter Thiel is always an interesting one. Alex Karp was dressed in a very interesting outfit, not the usual suit and tie kind of. He was very casual.
Who's he?
Alex Karp is he owns Palantir. He's a big Silicon Valley guy. So is Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is a Trump supporter, actually, as it's been reported in the media. It'll be interesting to hear his exchanges with Lindsey Graham in there, who's part of the anti-Trump Republican movement. I'd quite like to be a fly on the wall in their conversations today.
What about, because this Brexit vote's coming up soon, isn't it, as well, in a couple of weeks' time, the referendum. Do you think there's much of a connection between what we're seeing here and that?
Well, Bilderberg was quite heavily involved in the formation of the European Union. Joseph Rettinger was part of the European movement early on, one of the founders. It's been quite a topic of conversation at Bilderberg over the years, so, and a lot of key Bilderberg members have talked about their fears for the possible Britain's exit from the European Union in the past year in the run-up to the vote. So, yeah, I reckon it's a pretty big topic of conversation this weekend, near the top of the agenda, I'd say.
Right, well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, the Brexit thing. I mean, I wonder what's going to happen. Nobody really quite knows, but one does wonder if it's a sort of elephant in the room here, because if Britain does go out, there are all sorts of reasons why people might like that, particularly other European countries that see Britain as a kind of almost like a cat's paw for the United States. Anyway, where I'm sat from here, thanks very much, Daniel, you've got a kind of the King of Saxony's castle on one side. You've got something that we're actually sitting right next to is called the Zwinger, which is a giant Rococo arena with, if you have a look at the top, the Greek god Atlas is looking out very carefully over all of the public entrances to that. That's the god of strength and endurance. So that was what was put here in the 1700s for the local king. Also, the Bilderberg conference is right next to something called the Sophienstrasse, and this city really is built on top of the, well, just right around really, the River Elbe. And the Taschenberg Palace, where this is all happening, is a pretty posh five-star hotel. It was originally built in 1708 on a little hill called the Taschenberg Hill, and it was rebuilt after the bombing from the Second World War in 1995 and opened as Saxony's very first ever five-star hotel. So I'm joined now by Glenn Bolton. Glenn, are you impressed with the venue?
Yeah, I think Dresden's absolutely stunning. Really impressed. It's amazing, yeah.
What about your motives? What are your reasons for coming over here?
Well, I first attended Bilderberg about 4 years ago at Watford. And up until then, I thought I was like the only person that was, I thought I was mad, to be fair. And then when I went to Watford and seen about 5,000 people all into the same thing as me, I realised that I wasn't alone, and I've been coming ever since.
So, what, are you a journalist? What's your day job?
Well, absolutely. No, I'm a taxi driver. I've actually brought my taxi 1,000 miles from Newcastle in the north of England to here, as I did last year in Austria. I drove my taxi to Austria. I'm the conspiracy cabbie on YouTube, and that's what I do.
What was the journey like? Any incidents on the journey? It's quite a long way to drive.
No, it was absolutely brilliant. I think it's part of the fun, actually, travelling through different places and different sights and smells. It's all part of the journey. You don't get that on an aeroplane when you're here in 2 hours or something. Yeah.
Tell me, what are the other sort of things? You're obviously here over here for the Bilderberg, but it's not your only interest, is it?
No, not at all. I'm more interested in the friends that I've made over the 4 years. I come here mainly for my friends to hook up once a year at Bilderberg and we'll have a good time. I couldn't tell you half of the Bilderberg attendees if they run up and punched us in the face, to be fair. But I just love being here. I love the friends that I've made, and it's quite a lonely world, you know, without them.
What about the other sorts of conspiracies? Because I know that actually up in Newcastle, that you're on the radio from time to time, aren't you, up there?
I am, yeah. I phoned the local nighttime presenter on Metro FM, who's one of the biggest in England, and he's really into conspiracies. So I let him know the conspiracies that's happening at the moment, and he's quite knowledgeable, and he gives us a lot of time, yeah.
Okay, what was it when you, can you remember when you first heard about the Bilderbergers and what it was that piqued your interest?
I think it was after 9/11. I realised after 9/11 that something wasn't right, that the American government was claiming that these terrorists in a cave had caused all this damage and loss of life. I knew that was the start of it. I'm obviously too young to remember JFK, but 9/11 was my JFK, and I just started doing deep research and realised all wasn't what them were saying it was.
Are there any other sorts of conspiracies other than the 9/11 attacks, the Bilderbergs, that you come across? I mean, do you guys actually get involved in the sort of minutiae of politics up in Newcastle? Because I imagine there's quite a lot up there going on.
Well, there is. In Newcastle, there's a lot of poor people who take out these payday loans, you know, where they borrow £100 and they've got to pay, like, you know, £2,000 back. And I help them sort of with bailiffs and with debt recovery and writing letters. That's my main goal at the moment.
Well, one of the things I could actually write with you on that, because I know some of the banks actually defraud people who have got mortgages. And you were telling me earlier on about one particular incident you were involved with. It sounded absolutely horrendous, where some poor chap thought he'd been paying his mortgage, but he hadn't, and they tried to evict him.
Yeah, that's right. That story's on YouTube. If anybody wants to look at the story, if you just search for Tom Crawford, Tom had paid his mortgage for 25 years. And when he went to make his final payment, the bank instructed him that the £44,000 mortgage that he had, he still owes £43,000 because them had him on an interest-only mortgage, and it wasn't the mortgage that he was on, and he showed them proof that that wasn't the kind of mortgage. Yet it went to court, and because it went to court, the judge had to side with the bank, because when you get a mortgage, you sign papers to give the bank or the mortgage company power of attorney, so them can change the rules on you without you even knowing it. So the bank had to rule the judge ruled in the bank's favour. Yeah.
Now, I mean, you might say there's no connection at all between that and Bilderberg, but actually there is, because we're dealing with financial criminals. We're dealing with HSBC going through a massive fraud case in the United States, where they're doing money laundering for the Mexican drug cartels. Basically, enormous fraud on an enormous scale. Do you think there's ever anything we're going to be able to do about, particularly the banking crimes that are at Bilderberg and up in Newcastle? Because these guys seem to be too big to jail.
I think what's going to happen over the next couple of years, all these banks are going to fail anyway. So I think karma's a lovely thing, and they really are. I think they're heading for a major catastrophe. I think they're heading for a bigger depression than 2008, and even in the 1930s, karma's coming their way.
What makes you say that?
I just do. I mean, even though the past couple of weeks, the German and French banks have lost something like $20 billion in 90 days. So it's coming. Every forecaster that I listen to has said the banks are, like the Deutsche Bank in Germany, it's got, I think, about...
That's supposed to be the safest bank in the world at one time.
I think it's got about $17 trillion worth of these mortgage default swaps and credit default swaps, and things that are just not worth anything. And when them come home to roost, they are finished.
Fascinating, Glenn. Anyway, just remind us about where people can find you up online.
I'm on YouTube. I'm the Conspiracy Cabbie TV. Yeah.
Okay, Glenn. Okay, so we're just going to hand back to the studio now, Billy. And
thank you very much, Tony.
Back in about 10 minutes.
Well, hold on the line a second, because there's, as you know, the European Championship is kicking off in Paris this evening. You're on the ground in Dresden, surrounded by hundreds of the world's most powerful anonymous people.
Well, no, we're surrounding them, actually.
Nice to know. Is there any disturbances there? Is it safe? Is there any bad behaviour? Miscreancy?
It's perfectly fine. Nothing at all, really. Although there has been a few arrests of journalists and harassment of journalists. I've just been chatting to Alan, and I think it's Marie. Is it Marie? Maria, who came down from Hull, I think. I'm not sure if they were both from Hull, but they had a terrible time with the police yesterday. Basically, they were singled out and dragged off for nothing more than having two cardboard banners that the police didn't like. I mean, there was a tiny amount of swearing possibly on there, but, you know, this is really the way they were treated was appalling. They were dragged off, handcuffed, and then Maria was released, having been told that, but they haven't actually arrested her, and that's what the police have told the local media here, that there was no arrest of Maria. And also, according to Alan anyway, he was really quite badly beaten up by the police and had £100 stolen from him by the police as some kind of fine, an unofficial fine. So, you know, I think there's an attempt to go around the press that are covering this and find maybe some of the people who they can kind of peel off from the main press pack and simply harass or physically assault.
And are these uniformed German police or are they some special Stasi police?
They're uniformed German police, and you know, many of the press, they're being quite reasonable, although they certainly wanted to ID everybody the first night we were here, and they waited until everyone was heading off to their hotels and singled them all out and ID'd them. But I think it's pretty clear that there's an attempt to intimidate people one by one, so that they're not covering the conference as they could and they should do. And particularly this couple got this English couple got horrific treatment. We had Luke Gradowski from We Are Change. You'll find him online at Luke We Are Change. The police also went into his hotel room, did a massive search for no real reason. They had no evidence that he was doing anything wrong, and of course he wasn't. And a lot of harassment of him, and he was told that he had to keep well away from the venue, otherwise they would beat him up. That's what he told me. There has been some harassment, but you know, we try not to let that distract from actually making the connections about the new people that are turning up at these conferences. And I get really quite worried about the extent to which the conference is moving towards control of technology, particularly the data mining side of it. And maybe we can talk about that when we come back in 10 or 15 minutes' time.
Indeed, let's do that. I just mentioned, because for the second night in succession, French riot police in full riot gear have used tear gas on British football fans in the city centre in Marseille. I just thought it would be an interesting compare and contrast between the mood on the streets in Dresden with the Bilderberg group and the joyous football fan
one
mood.
One of the things that maybe we can talk about as well in a minute, Billy, is this kind of new thing of stadium terror attacks, real and unreal, but we'll be talking about that in a minute.
Yes, let's. Thank you, Tony. We look forward to hearing from you anon. Right, folks, we're going to take a breath for some music, and sometimes in life you just have to go a little misty.
Look at me, I'm as helpless a kitten up a tree. And I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud I can't understand. I get misty just holding your hand. Walk my way, and a thousand violins begin to play. Or it might be the sound of your hello, that music I hear. I get misty the moment you're near. You can say that you're leading me on, you to do. Don't you notice how hopelessly I'm lost? That's why I'm following you. On my own, would I wander through this wonderland alone? Ever knowing my right foot from my left, my hat from my glove. I'm too misty and too much in love. Too much in love. Look at me.
Earl Garner with Misty. It's the Politics Show here on Bristol Community 93.2 FM. I'm Billy Quain, sitting in for Tony Gosling, because as we just heard, he is in Dresden. And for the first time this evening, Martin Summers, Labour economist, old Labour economist.
Is the strap line, yes, invented by Tony Martin.
Let's tease out this job title then. Old Labour Oxford economist. Explain this to me.
It's Tony Gosling's strap line for me. What it means is that I suppose I could be described as an old Labour person rather than a new Labour person. And I've got a degree in economics from Oxford University, so that's what it falls down
that
to.
That must put you on the horns of a dilemma now, because current Labour is kind of old Labour again.
Well, it's not a dilemma at all. I mean, I've hung around all this time for those old tunes to be played again, and they are being played
so
again.
So is it now neo-Labour?
Well, I think that, you know, it doesn't make much point talking about these things, does it? I
mean,
new Labour. I mean, where does it end, you know?
Absolutely. No, we have got some interesting conversational tidbits to cogitate over for a little while, not least of which is the Boundary Commission. I want you to listen to some audio. This was Stephen Pound in the Houses of Parliament this week.
Stephen Pound, in the spirit of consensus, Mr. Speaker. May I say that there are few things that unite the House more than a concentration on the periodic reviews and of the Boundary Commission, which is being studied with a fierce intensity, and covetous eyes are occasionally cast on neighbouring constituencies. However, we do note that the electorate of the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea and the City of Westminster has declined precipitously and against all logic. Does the Chancellor believe that the Prime Minister should be concerned about this? And if so, What should he be doing?
Well, I thought he was the Member of Parliament for Ealing, but there we go. The boundary review are doing their work. They're drawing up in an independent way, which is a good thing about our country. The boundaries, and we'll see their proposals, I think, later this year, their initial proposals.
So that sounded like George Osborne taking the question, Martin Summers. And Stephen Pound mentioned that the precipitous drop in the electorate in Kensington and Chelsea. Is there an underhand twist of knife there, suggesting that all of the council taxpayers in Kensington and Chelsea are non-domiciled people?
Well, I think there was some amusement, wasn't there, in the House there about that. I mean, the fact of the matter is, and certainly in Bristol West, where we're seated now, there were less people on the electoral register at the last election last year than at the previous election 4 years previously, even though we know from all the huffing and puffing from UKIP, etc., that the population of Britain has increased. But there's less people on the electoral register. And
what do we put this down to? Surely it's not all Middle Eastern and Russian multimillionaires buying...
No, well, certainly not in Bristol West.
BS5.
What we're talking about, really, is that there's always... When the poll tax was introduced originally in the 1980s, I think it was a very conscious decision by the fixers behind it that poor people would be discouraged from registering to vote. Because previously, of course, they'd paid rates... And if they were living in council or social housing, they wouldn't have even seen the rate bill. It would have been paid by their landlord, and it would be a notional part of their rent. So, in other words, it was quite straightforward to register to vote. And as Tony Benn pointed out years ago, he used to be MP for Bristol, the point about people who are poor, you get a vote to vote for saying, we want stuff, and you're going to have to pay for it. That's the bottom line. Wealthy people have to pay for what poor people vote to have. And of course Thatcher brought in the poll tax because she realised that people in Streatham, she even said this, people in Streatham were paying for youth clubs in Brixton, and that really got stuck in her throat. And she thought, if people want youth clubs in Brixton, they've got to pay for it themselves. And that was the whole idea behind the poll tax and council tax, which is what modern local government finance is based on, is poll tax Mark II. It's still based on an individual, because the property used to pay taxes as the owners of property, not individual people. And that was a very efficient way of funding local government. Incidentally, of course, they still have the rates in Northern Ireland, because it would have been impossible to introduce... I mean, the poll tax was introduced in Scotland as a provocation, and we've now seen where that's led, possibly to the breakup of the UK all these years later. But they never tried to introduce it in Belfast, for example, because neither on the Falls or the Shankill Road would guys coming to collect people's tellies for refusing to pay had a very welcome reception.
It sounds fascinating. We're going to re-plow this furrow after we hear from Noel Coward, and then we're going to hear from Tony Gosling.
The security forces are already overstretched.
I'll get the right track this time, I promise. I really will.
The beastly to the Germans. Now our victory is ultimately won. Let us treat them very kindly, as we would a valued friend. We might send them out some bishops as a form of lease and lend. Let's be sweet to them and day by day repeat to them that sterilization simply isn't done. Let's sweetly sympathize again and help the scum to rise again. But don't let's be beastly to the Hun. We must be kind, and with an open mind, we must endeavor to find a way to let the Germans know that now the war is over, they are not the ones who have to pay. We must be sweet, and tactful, and discreet, and now they've suffered defeat, we mustn't let them feel upset or ever get the feeling that we're cross with them or hate them. Our future policy must be to reinstate them. Don't let's be beastly to the Germans, for they're civilized when all is said and done. Though they gave us science, culture, art and music to excess, they also gave us 2 world wars and Dr. Rudolf Hess. Let's be meek to them and turn the other cheek to them and try to arouse their latent sense of fun. Let's give them full our parity and treat the rats with charity, but don't let's be beastly to the Hun. Don't let's be beastly to the Germans, for you can't deprive a gangster of his gun. though they've been a little naughty to the Czechs and Poles and Dutch. I can't believe those countries really minded very much. Let's be free with them and share the BBC with them. We mustn't prevent them basking in the sun. Let's soften their defeat again and build their rebel fleet again, but don't let's be beastly to the Hun.
So
they want a racketeer visit.
You see, we're not being beastly to the Germans because Noel Coward told us to not be. But I'll tell you one man who might be is Tony Gosling in Dresden as one part of the monitoring group of the Bilderberg Group meeting. So, Tony, this is a weird sort of meta network that you find yourself amongst, monitoring people who refuse to talk to you.
Well, we're not being beastly to the Germans at all, actually, although some of the German police have been being beastly to some of us, haven't they? And I'm joined now by Luke Radowski. Luke, you've had a bit of a bad experience with these police here, haven't you?
Oh, just to say the least. I mean, we had police officers intimidate, harass knowingly. They literally stole my video camera, made sure that we were not filming, and then looked me dead in the eyes and told me, yes, we are here to intimidate and harass you on behest of the Bilderberg Group. They have files on us that they carry around. They look at the files. They point us out in the middle of the streets. They threaten to sue us. They went into our hotel room, searched us illegally without permission, and they also threatened physical violence on me if they see me anywhere near the Bilderberg Hotel. Well, right now, we are right in front of the Bilderberg Hotel, and we are making significant headway with documenting everything that's happening here, breaking the mainstream media blackout by reporting on this independently, free on the internet. And those ideas, those videos, those pictures are spreading around all over the internet like wildfire because of people sharing them, because of people caring about this issue, which obviously everyone should when you actually find out what's happening here. But right now, just moments ago, we talked to the main police chief. He's we're complaining, we're filing all the paperwork, we're going to bring some lawsuits on this situation, because what's happening here to journalists who just want to report what's happening is illegal and also very immoral.
But from a media point of view, it's difficult, isn't it? Because all you can see is smoky glass Mercedes going in and out. You can't actually talk to these guys at all.
Yeah, even at the airport. Previously, a few years ago, they used to just go through the airport and go through the public entrances. But then we would be there and we would walk up to the Bilderberg members and we would say, hey, what are you doing here? What are you doing in this particular town? What will be discussed? What's going on? Let's have some transparency. And because of that, now, as of yesterday, they had private jets, private hangars, private streets, everything blocked off, backway entrances, totally blacked out mirrors. And as we know, the Bilderberg Group, who says that they're very transparent, releases a list. But a lot of times in previous years, it has been documented that people who were at the conference were not on the official list, which shows you that their transparency is just a full charade because everything's closed off. It's like Fort Knox over here. There's no way to get any kind of transparency and accountability from your public officials who are supposed to represent you, who are using tax dollars with these insane police state tactics against journalists who are in there deciding policy with the corporate globalist empire that everyone, I think, is pretty much aware of is really running things behind the scenes.
But actually, I mean, they'll say, Luke, this is a private meeting. I mean, if you wanted to have a private meeting, you're entitled to that, aren't you?
How is it a private meeting when you're using public funds to facilitate this, when you're using state, federal police to protect, and also intelligence agencies to protect these individuals, when you have members of your own government who are supposed to represent you coming to these meetings and swearing an oath of silence to not be accountable for the decisions that they made with Goldman Sachs, with BP, with HSBC, with Facebook, with Google, with artificial intelligence companies. I mean, for God's sakes, people, look at the list of just what they admitted, and it should already have people losing their hair in stress knowing that these people are doing this. Obviously, private meetings are private meetings. You have to, respect that. But when it comes to using public funds, when it comes to doing this so blatantly in our face, even some of the statements that some of the Bilderberg members have made are just outrageous. These people have a lot of power. They know it. They use it. And they love this kind of conspiracy kind of aura around them, and they feed off of it. And really, it's kind of a duopoly, but we could get into that later.
They always seem to cultivate this air of mystery, don't they?
They definitely do, and I think it's done on purpose sometimes to empower them. So they really, see, are seen like this shadowy, secretive group, which they are, but I think they grovel in it because all they had to do from a PR standpoint is treat this like the G7, open it up for press on some levels, take some questions, and then have their private closed-door sessions, which do happen at the G7. That's understandable. But they don't do that. They go out of their way to punish journalists who mention this. There's also, and it's very important to know, there's also the people who work for the mainstream media, who are in control of the mainstream media, who own the mainstream media, who are also tied into Bilderberg, who are also there, who will never say anything about this meeting, who won't violate their oath of secrecy. And that's why we're seeing just no, particularly almost no mainstream media coverage when this is happening. Imagine if 150 celebrities came together for a secret meeting like this. The mainstream media would be foaming at the mouth. They would be shaking and going insane if this happened. But these are politicians. These are bankers. This is the military-industrial complex. These are the top echelons of power doing this in front of our eyes. And where is the mainstream media?
Well, good question. They've had one or two, haven't they? But not many. Look, you've done a really good job over the years in between the Bilderberg meetings of actually confronting some of these guys when they're out in public, haven't you?
Well, as a journalist, you have to ask questions and demand answers. The real job of a journalist is to hold politicians accountable for their actions so we could have real transparency so there couldn't be any tyranny. That's the basic function of journalism, is to hold power accountable. It's to be that check and to be that balance in society. And that's what I do. I go up to the media figures who attend. I go up to the bankers. I go up to the politicians. And I ask them point blank. I look them dead in the eyes. And I'm like, what'd you do? Well, what happened? Tell us. And as soon as that happens, they freak out. They start trembling. It's like they've seen a freaking ghost. They call security. They call the police. They have me arrested. They have me intimidated. And all I do is politely as I can. And I'm from New York, and I even have to scale back. I have to, like, really try to be polite. And I try so hard, politely, coming up to these people. And I'm like, okay, sir, what did you do at the Bilderberg meeting, please? And then still, with that utter politeness, it's just a total freak out.
And why is that? They're not allowed to talk about it at all, really? And why is that?
Well, we could speculate on so many different things, but obviously they swear an oath of secrecy. Obviously there's probably some inner dirt that people hide from each other. There's probably some oath. There's probably some contracts. There's probably some non-disclosure agreements. I don't know.
But have you ever got any sense out of any of the people? Who have you confronted? Even, you know, there's people up to Kissinger, Rockefeller.
Well, Tony Blair. Tony Blair was amazing. Tony Blair went to the House of Commons, told your House of Commons, your representative government, I have never been to Bilderberg. I don't know what you're talking about. I came up to him, blindsided him one time when he was taking pictures. His security guards were like, what the hell is happening here? Came up to him. I'm like, hey, Tony, hey, how's the Bilderberg meeting? What happened there? He's like, oh, yeah, I had a lovely time. It was great. And I'm like, wait, Mr. Tony Blair, you told the House of Commons that you were never there, and aren't you worried about the huge conflict of interest when it comes to meeting with corporations, banksters, the military-industrial complex behind closed doors with no transparency and no mention of the press of anything that this is happening? And then he looked at me in this bamboozled look like a deer in headlights, and he freaking... Watch the video. Go, seriously, Tony Blair, We Are Change. Look up your favorite politician. We Are Change, favorite politician. I don't care who it is. We confronted all of them. And we're doing this fully funded by user donations. Go to youtube.com/We Are Change. Look for your favorite politician. We got them. They're going to be running away. They're going to be cowards in the videos. You're going to see it all. Judge it for yourself. Tony Blair, especially. Ooh, you got to watch that one. It was lovely. It was beautiful.
Just take us through some of the social media you use, Luke, because that's the easiest way to get hold of this stuff, isn't it?
Well, I just used one username, Luke We Are Change, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. It's all Luke We Are Change, all just one word. And of course, you know, YouTube, it's just We Are Change. That's our main bread and butter. We survive off YouTube. We survive off donations. But YouTube is really everything that I've been putting all my energy into, because it's a platform where people could watch, share. All the audiences are there. Of course, there's some finagling. They've been messing with our channel, hurting our monetization. Of course. That happened also after we confronted Eric Schmidt, who at that time when we confronted him was running Google, that runs YouTube, and then our Google accounts have not been the same since. But it's still an excellent platform to reach out to people, but they're also trying to censor that in very sneaky ways as well.
That reminds me of Max Headroom, this drama series where quite a lot of what's happening is involving the guy that runs the channel. I think it's Channel 23 or something, and he's interrogating him. So you're actually trying to interrogate the guy that's running YouTube, and you're using YouTube to try and get it out.
You might as well use their own weapons against them, because in this day and age, we have a perfect time, we have a perfect opportunity where one voice, one human being, one soul could speak truth to the entire world, and there's nothing these people could do to stop it if the truth is powerful enough. And it is, and also they're understanding this, and that's why Eric Schmidt is at Bilderberg. That's why a lot of people from Facebook, Google, DeepMind, artificial intelligence are at Google. They understand this, and they have their sneaky ways of suppressing this.
Just one thing, let's just finish on Google itself, because it's becoming an incredibly powerful company. Just in the last few months, announced the richest company in the world. I was reading an article the other day by Gerald Frieda from The Signal, which is New Jersey College, saying that looking at the way that the search engine results, the algorithms that Google use, they can actually send potential candidates up and down through the listings, and they can add 13% to somebody's approval rating from the public that are searching on Google, and they could take away 25% from someone so that they can make them look bad, basically, by the results that Google turns up.
Yeah, there are scientific studies proving how Google could swing an election, could decide a major election just by changing the news algorithms, just by changing the search algorithms. They have this power. And of course, we know in the United States a lot of Google executives are working with Hillary Clinton. We know Google executives are here at Bilderberg. They understand this power. And it would be foolish for us to believe that they're not doing this for their own personal benefit. Because when you do talk about one of the largest corporations, which is wealthier than a lot of the countries around the world, obviously their main interest is to their shareholders, is to their financial benefit. And of course, power colludes with power. That is ultimately what is happening here. We cannot make any definitive statements on exactly what's happening, but obviously, you know it's not for your interest.
Okay, Luke, we are changed. That's where you'll find him online. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show. I'm also joined by Hannah Borno, who's been down here taking a lot of photographs. Hannah, you've been doing this for a few years now, haven't you?
Yep. Started in 2010, Sitges.
Okay, how have you seen the conferences over the last few years change? What are the things you've noticed?
The policing, it varies from year to year. I can't say it's evolved in any particular way because it's so random. It just depends on however that country's police force decides to handle it. But what has changed is during the meeting at Sitges, they did put up the website for the first time and published the participant list online. And I think that was in part, there was actually quite a lot of Spanish media involved and there was a big publicity push that year. Charlie Skelton was doing his reports for the Guardian website, and I think it was in part a response to that they put this website out there.
At least it's good, isn't it? It's starting to get into the mainstream media, not just in Britain. More and more media seem to be covering it almost every year, bit by bit, due to the work of people like Luke and us. And I mean, we were talking with Luke there about Google, because this seems to be increasingly a feature of Bilderberg. We've had Amazon, we've had LinkedIn, gosh, there's a whole list of them, Twitter, all these kinds of... we've got LinkedIn in there right at the very moment. And, of course, people give a fantastic amount of their personal private data, their CVs, their history to LinkedIn. And the business model is effectively the possibility to sell that data to the highest bidder, really, to auction off your personal private data.
Yeah, there's a saying, isn't there, that if you're not paying for the service, then the actual product is you yourself, and your data is the product that's on offer, then that's the profitability. We've had Eric Schmidt is now on the steering committee, as is Craig Mundy, the research director of Microsoft. And they've recently, it's like, I think the last 3-4 years, they've been aggressively recruiting young tech talent, not only to the Bilderberg meetings themselves, but also to the steering committee. So you've seen Peter Thiel, who was founder of PayPal and a funder of Facebook, join the steering committee. He then recruited his protege, Alex Karp, CEO of Palantir. I believe that was also partly funded by Peter Thiel, which is a data mining company and an extremely sinister, very, very powerful, very worrying business.
But it's also, I mean, I know I was looking this up earlier, and Palantir is also partly funded by something called InQtel, which effectively, it makes no bones about it, this is the NSA funding this as well.
Yeah, and he's not there this year, but often Keith Alexander attends, and he's attended both as, you know, in his actual role as director of the NSA, but also when he left, he continued to go to Bilderberg. So there's a lot of tech. Last year, there was a huge amount of interest in AI, and you had Regina Dugan, ex-DARPA, who's now joined Google. You had the young guy, Demis Hassabis, who is a co-founder of Google DeepMind, and he's there as well this year. The amount of tech talent that you see in there is startling and extremely worrying. I think the old guard realized they really needed to shape up. They needed to get with the times. They were, you know, just even looking from their website, you could see that it was all a bit clunky, a bit old-fashioned, and they needed to wise up or else they would be left behind. So they've had to recruit these guys. And interestingly enough, Airbus, Thomas Enders, the host here, is CEO of Airbus, have started doing deals with people like Palantir in order to modernize and to get this cutting-edge technology integrated into their business model. And they've just set up a big new branch in Silicon Valley to take advantage of this. And you can bet that he's getting a lot of advice from his steering committee co-pals, such as Thiel and Schmidt and Mundy.
But it's amazing, this Palantir company, I mean, they've stolen this word from the Lord of the Rings. This is this kind of globe in the Lord of the Rings that you used to use to communicate with each other. I was just looking at some of their work, and they've got something called Palantir Gotham, obviously reference to Gotham City and Batman. They've also got something called Palantir Metropolis. This is all to do effectively with government and to do with data mining. They're also they're selling their products to governments, saying that basically this kind of Palantir technology will help with cyber attacks. And they're even selling it, saying that our technology can help you stop the next terror attack. This is something we're not really, I suppose, most people can't understand how this technology works. It's almost like it's not just moving ahead of the law technology. It's almost moving ahead of our ability to comprehend it.
Yeah, and I think also the Bilderberg Group itself is needs these kind of little breakdowns. So you're going to get some presentations from the very best in the industry, such as Google DeepMind, and there's some guy that does things about, you know, wavelets, wave packets or whatever, which I don't know what it is, and they probably don't. Well, obviously they don't, but they're going to find out, and they'll get these presentations. But also, look at it. I mean, one of the agenda items is cybersecurity, and you can bet again that, you know, Alex Karp will be basically practically pitching for business. You know, he'll be saying, we are Palantir, this is what we do, and he'll be talking to, you know, a whole room full of, you know, people who can make the decision to buy this software and this product and their expertise.
But these data mining firms, what they seem to do nowadays is they sell themselves on the ability to actually really steal databases, to find ways of accessing databases, getting that information possibly from places, you know, places like the cloud, actually maybe hacking into foreign countries, national, possibly even, you know, military. We don't know where they're going, but that's what they boast of, that we can get into where nobody else can get into and get that data and bring it back. What they're effectively doing, Hannah, it seems, is trying to build up a massive database on everybody on the planet to profile people.
Yes, and of course, the more data they have, the more they can create these really acute psychological profiles. They can predict your behavior. It's not, data is more than the sum of its parts. Each little nugget of data when you add them all up together, it's cumulative, and you get so much more insight into patterns of behaviour and the way somebody's going to behave. But interestingly, I'm quite interested in this kind of melding of government organisations and these private companies, and you see it a lot. In fact, the first person to do it was Kissinger, who left the US government. Well, left, I mean, he never really left, but he immediately set up Kissinger Associates, which mainly works for governments, but it is obviously a private company. And now you see a whole lot of them doing it now. You know, Keith Alexander, John Sawyers, ex-MI6, has now gone to Macro Advisory.
He's just come onto the steering committee of Bilderberg too, hasn't he? Martin, on our show, Martin, every week, you can hear him almost banging the studio desk saying that Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, said on French television that before the Arab Spring that there was a approach to him by officials in London anyway, effectively MI6, saying we want to start an uprising in Syria. So this is the kind of guy that's over in the room over there. But look, let's get away from this technology for a minute and talk about some of the more practical stuff, because I've just been charting the kind of new sort of terrorism. It started with the Paris attacks November the 14th in the Stade de France. Altogether 130 dead there. At the actual stadium, there were three bombs and I think one or two deaths, but no arrests, and the bombers didn't actually make it into the stadium. Then we saw just after that, in Hanover, Germany, a football match was cancelled on November the 18th, just a few days afterwards. I think it was Germany versus Holland in Hanover. And then March the 25th this year, we had near Baghdad a massive stadium bomb, 30 people killed. And then 15th of May, the most recent one, at Old Trafford, Man United versus Bournemouth, the match completely called off due to a fake bomb being found. Now, this seems to be sort of almost like a venue for this, but two of those, it looks like, weren't really anything at all. The one in Hanover and Old Trafford. And looking at the reporting of it, it's interesting that the crowds don't seem to mind if a whole match is abandoned due to some sort of fake bomb attack. But this makes things very vulnerable and has a big psychological effect on the people at the football match. I just wonder what you make of this.
Well, I think they're probably realizing that actually you can impact people's lives in other ways. You don't have to detonate a bomb and, you know, whatever, create that theatre. You can actually impact on thousands of people's lives by just changing their Saturday afternoon. They're really looking forward to an important match. You know, it's their sort of, you know, thing they've been looking forward to all week. They're going to go out there with their mates. They're going to have a few beers. They're really going to enjoy this. And their Saturday afternoon is ruined, and so therefore they'll be feeling slightly aggrieved, maybe a little bit angry. They will then blame, you know, the, in inverted commas, the terrorists, and then perhaps look to government to normalise things and to make things, again in inverted commas, safe again.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see how this that particular one develops. We're just building a big arena in Bristol at the moment. You know, that's the sort of thing that worries me when we see that things like that happening. Anyway, thanks very much for having a chat with us, Hannah. I just wanted to leave by asking you do you think is the one big take home from Bilderberg, what you've picked up over the years?
Well, one big take home. What Glenn was saying earlier in the program about just making these contacts and speaking to people and, you know, coming to stand outside the gates, that's really important. And the reason we're outside the gates is because we want to hold these politicians who are joining these meetings to account. We want transparency. Yes, CEOs of banks and corporations can meet privately all day long if they wish. They can do deals all day long behind closed doors. But the moment you've got an elected public official there listening to those deals, giving them information, you know, perhaps being influenced by them, because let's not forget it, some of the biggest lobbyists are in there, lobbyists for TTIP and lobbyists for all sorts of special interests, and, you know, the oil industry, the the aerospace. There's so many massive, the creme de la creme of lobbyists are in there, and they've got these politicians locked up with them for 3 days. And that's why we're there. That's why we stand outside the gates. We want to get, you know, to show the world that these politicians need to be held accountable.
And it's also very nice for us as journalists and other people covering it. We get a lot of interesting people to have supper with, which we're going to go and do a bit later.
Yes, indeed. But one thing I will say is that this year the finance ministers are like a herd of frightened gazelles, and they're all going in through the back door. They're going down into an underground garage, and they're just basically cowering because they're scared of our cameras. And I just find it despicable.
Well, that's actually really worrying, isn't it? It makes you think that maybe there is something being planned financially. Anyway, Hannah Bourneau, thanks very much. I'll hand back to the studio. Be with you all next week, I hope.
Thank you very much indeed, Tony. Well done. It sounds like you're having a blast there in Dresden. Don't get yourself arrested and enjoy your dinner.
Thanks very much. Cheers, Billy.
Take care. Martin Summers, that's it. We've got the news now. I'm sorry, we didn't really get to chat
that's
about
fine.
Much at all.
That's fine.
Mohammed Makawi's next with Leila Arabia. Do stay tuned to BCFM. I'm back at 10 o'clock tomorrow with the Saturday edition. Have a great weekend, everybody. Remember, the M32 is closing at 8 o'clock tonight, not reopening until 6 on Monday morning. Whatever you need to do, get it done in the next hour. Take care.
And on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.